Joshua 24. It would be my wish that today and next week would conclude our Sunday morning or Sunday school studies into the subject of worship, and then we'll be moving on to a different topic area. But we've said many things in the weeks leading up to today, and most recently concluding with the truth underlined that the children need to learn to worship. And we've gone through some details on why and how and all that that goes on. And I want to begin today with the concept of a family altar. And have you look in Joshua 24, where we are going to connect worship and the home. And we want to make you understand that, have you understand that there's a connection between private worship and public worship. There is a link between the strength of a home and the strength of any church. There is, thank you, Mr. Reddick. You're a kind man. Your wife gave me this.
Yeah, your wife gave you
is that right? Okay. Thank you. Everybody's so pleasurable today. You're a good man. But there's also a link between the strength, the spiritual strength of a father to his wife, to his children. And we find an instance here in Joshua 24, verse 15, after the Israelites had pretty much cleared out all the ites and were taking charge over the land that God had assigned, there's a fatherly declaration in the 15th verse. A fatherly declaration. And may I also point out to you the obvious, that it is a fatherly responsibility. But I also want to, as we discuss in the beginning part of the class, worship in the home, there may be the temptation on the part of folks to think that the subject of worship as it regards children only has to do when children are under the roof of the parents. But we're going to see another family altar this morning where a father's responsibility to his children go quite beyond the age of maturity, typically thought in our culture anyway as 18 thereabouts, and then they go on their own. And I'm not quite sure that I'm prepared to say that there is any time in the life of a parent where they are relieved from their obligations and their responsibilities to have an impact on their children when it comes to the worship of the eternal God. Now, the declaration made by Joshua is this: if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord. And remember, we've always connected these concepts of worship, service, and sacrifice. They're all intertwined. Worship, service, and sacrifice. And he says, if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve. So I want to just stop for a moment and come back on the word choose. Back on the word choose just for a moment. And have you to understand this. That for the child of God, a choice can be made that is consistent with the will of God. Now, unbelievers, they don't operate in that sphere at all. An unbeliever, an unsaved person, can only choose in a manner that's consistent with their depraved nature. So it's understandable that unbelievers typically do not enter into worship that is defined by Jesus as worship in spirit and in truth. Unbelievers, as a matter of course, will be uncomfortable if they attempt to worship in their spiritual state, whether it's private, there will not be that inclination, and in public, it will be a matter of comfort. There's no comfort there. But the believer has within the sphere of ability to make a choice, and he always has the ability to choose what's right. Always has the ability to choose what's right. And a believer, a child of God, having made the choice, is able to make that kind of exercise that option in a manner that's consistent with God's will at all times. So he says, choose you this day whom you will serve. Now keep in mind, serve, sacrifice, worship. Serve, sacrifice, worship. All intertwined. He says, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. See, one thing doesn't change. God, there are gods from where you came. Okay? There are gods where you are. But there is, most importantly, one true God, Jehovah. So here there are three designations here. He challenges his people with this. You've got to make a choice here now. There are the gods your father served on the other side of the flood. There are the gods of the Amorites, the people of the land where you're living at right now. Or there is the God. Which God will you serve? Now, the believer has the opportunity and the ability to choose, to make a choice that's consistent with God's will. Now, we've already covered the ground that true worship is reserved exclusively for God alone. Only our God is worthy and deserving of worship. Only our God. But the challenge goes out. He challenges those who are under him, who are brothers with him. And he says this, but as for me, he reveals his choice. As for me, Joshua says. And please notice what follows. Because this flies right in the face of contemporary religious culture. He says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now keep in mind, serve, sacrifice, integral parts of worship. Now, when I said or pointed out the clash here, it says, as for me, now some men would satisfy or salve their conscience right there and say, maybe to the wife, to the children, to anybody else who may be living in the home, look, as for me, I'm going to worship God. What you do is up to you. And it's more often than not common for even Christian parents to take that attitude with regard to their children. I'm going to worship and serve God, but you can do what you want. It's up to you. You're old enough to make your own choice. And the truth of the matter is, that is not a choice that you give to those in your house. As for me and my house, Joshua says, we will serve the Lord. Now that's a father's responsibility, not only to make sure that he is vertically related to God according to the will of God, but that his household likewise is in the same fashion. Now, that's just a simple declaration. How do you go about this practically when we think about worship and the home? Well, I want you to follow along with me and keep that train of thought in mind, because it spans not only here in Joshua, but even precedes this. Go back to Genesis 18, and we're going to follow this from the beginning to the end. Worship in the home, and we're going to make a case for the family altar. In Genesis 18, and the 19th verse, remember what Joshua said, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. For me and my house. Me, my wife, and my children. Now remember, leave open the door for this thought. What do I do when my children leave my house? What should I do then? What are the limits of my responsibility to them as the head of the house. Okay? Genesis 18:19. It is said of Abraham, I know him. The Lord says, I know him. Isn't that a pleasurable thought? That as you sit here this morning, that you're not just another name and number in the heart of God, but He knows you personally. After all, He's your Father. He says, I know him, that he will command his children. And what's next? And his household. He will command his children and his household after him. And how does that, how's that all fleshed out? What form does that take? They says they will keep the way of the Lord. They will keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment. Justice, righteousness, judgment, proper discernment. Judgment here is to fall down on the right side of an issue as God sees it. To do justice and judgment that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. And what did he speak of him? In the preceding verse, just look at that. The preceding verse, the 18th verse says, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. A point of interest to us here is simply this. God said, I know Abraham, that he will command his children. They're going to keep the way of the Lord. And as a result of that, there are going to be blessings that accrue to him. And to, as a result, to others. Now, open the door of this thought. And see what's all at stake here. Because it's not all, you know, your family, my family, are not isolated entities. We do not live in a vacuum. What we do touches the lives of so many others, and so it is here with Abraham. He said, I know him, and according as he will guide his household, there will be blessings accrue to him personally, but to everybody else as well. Do you realize that that your home, rightly ordered, planted in your neighborhood, is light and salt in your neighborhood? And it, the way you conduct your home is a witness and a testimony to everybody and anybody about you. Your lives are living epistles to be known and read of all men. Such was with Abraham. Then the well-known reference there in Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22. And the sixth verse, what it says and what it means, and what it doesn't say. Proverbs 22:6. Remember what Joshua said, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Just like Abraham. Now, Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child. Train up a child in the way he should go. Now, keep in mind, I want to stop on the word should for a moment. On the way he should go. You know, in spite of how mom and dad may train their child as how they should go, sometimes they won't go. So who's responsible then? Well, the child is. If you train up your child in the way they should go and they won't go, that's on them. And when you stand before your Lord at the Bema seat and give an account for your family, one thing ought not to be laid to your charge is this by the Lord, is that you were negligent in guiding your home and commanding your children. But he says, train up your child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, that's the goal. The goal of it all is that when that there is a fatherly responsibility where worship is concerned, to prepare the child adequately for the day when the child will begin to make their own choices and decisions and choose what's right, to do justice and judgment. Because realistically, there comes a point in time where you don't have 24/7 oversight over your children. And when they leave your home and they establish their own homes or they go about their own adult lives, you're pretty much limited at that point. And all that you have ever done previous to that will tell the tale. And it should never be laid to the charge of any parent that when they have grown old and they lived the life of a reprobate, it wasn't because they didn't have the proper education, encouragement, and instruction to live for God. Now, it goes without saying that when you look at that verse, train up a child, you can't train somebody in an area you don't have any familiarity with. Michael's here today with his family. How nice it is to see him. And Michael's fixing to get ready to put a shingle up. He's going to be a professional artist of the healing arts. And so, you know, it may be that he will be used of God somewhere along the line to train someone else to do what he does. And that would be appropriate. But it would be foolish for Kaminsky to try to train you to be a chiropractor. Now, I could give you some ideas on how you might crack your bones or put your misaligned spine in place from the old school days, but I guarantee they don't work because they didn't work for me. You know? If you doubt me and your back, how many of you have sore backs today? If you have a sore back, you come up here and you lay down on your stomach right here in the aisle and I'm going to walk on top of your back. And I guarantee you'll be out of your misery. Yes. You won't feel a thing after a while. But that's not training anybody to do the right thing. So, it goes without saying that a father exercising his responsibility to serve the Lord and to make sure his household does it must know something about the matter himself. Which goes to say he must be a worshiper. Worship, serve, sacrifice. And when his children not only hear what he says is the right thing to do, but see that he does it himself, they're more inclined as they grow older to follow in the path. There's no guarantees on that, but the likelihood is greater if that's the case. Now, okay, say, well, you looked at Joshua, you looked at Abraham, and here you have Solomon commenting on it in Proverbs 22. In Ephesians chapter 6, you have another notation about worship in the home. Ephesians 6, a well-traveled place in the Scripture, used by parents to either beat down their children or used by children to escape or rationalize their indolence. Ephesians 6, verse 1, children, obey your parents. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. Now, verse 4, to the point. Fatherly responsibility. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up. And here it is. Josh has asked for me in my house, we will serve the Lord. Paul to the Ephesian fathers in that church says, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Bring them up day by day. What's the actual process by which that is carried on? Well, you go back into Deuteronomy chapter 4, 5, and 6, where a father, when he's awake, he brings them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. When he goes to bed, he's bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. When he walks by the way, he brings them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. In other words, a father should never compartmentalize his instruction to his children on the subject of worship or gaining knowledge of God, because it's a 24/7, unceasing, unending practice until the day comes when your daughter says, I do, and she's gone. Or your son says, I will, and he's gone. But until that time comes, there are certain responsibilities that you have where children are concerned. Worship in the home to create a family altar. As a matter of fact, you're in the New Testament. Look at 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4. Things that a person learns over the course of their life are first learned in the home. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4. If any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Worship in the home. So let me come back again and just review. If you have any questions, by all means, or comments, inject at this time. But I will say to you that the strength of a home, the spiritual strength of a home, rides on the spiritual might of a father. And in the case where there, in so many homes, and especially in our culture, it is true, but it's not unique to our culture, where there are single parent homes, where the vast amount of situations involve mothers raising children, apart from or without the presence of a father, the responsibility unfortunately falls to the mother. It's not an impossible job because we have a God who is able to conquer the impossible. But the strength of a home will then determine the strength of a church. A strong church generally is made up in the main of strong families where public worship is a reflection of private, personal worship. Family altar time. Now, I want to flesh that out a little bit. Go to the book of Job, because this will touch upon the situation where, and of course, Shane and Jenny and Michael and his wife and Missy and Jeff and those who have smaller children in the house and Brent and so forth. You don't see it yet, but I want to tell you that where your children are now, they're not going to stay there long. They're not going to stay there long. You may think by the time they reach 18, they've been here long enough. It's time to hit the road. You may. But I will say to you, when they reach that age, you will be very reluctant to let them go emotionally. But it happens so fast. But when it happens and you have the empty nest and they're all gone, Job gives us a little bit of an encouragement as to what the role of the head of the home continues to be after the children are gone. In Job 1, first of all, know something about the man in the first verse. Well known. Said he was perfect man, upright. And one that feared God and eschewed evil, turned away from evil. Can I just make this comment about that? Where there is the presence of the fear of God, which, by the way, incites a person to worship, where there is the presence of the fear of God, there will also be a hatred of evil and a turning away from it. Incompatible, the fear of God and the fear of man, which basically is an intimidator that prevents us from responding correctly to evil, are incompatible. You either fear God or you fear man. You can't fear both. But if you fear God, you'll hate evil correspondingly. That was Job. And because he did, and I take it that he probably even old, antiquated, ancient Job knew a little bit of something about human anthropology, you know, the nature of man. He said there he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. 7 and 3. Gives a little bit about his personal assets in verse 3. And it says there, he was the greatest of all the men in the East. The greatest of all the men. And it says, his sons went and feasted. Sisters were there too. Now please notice in verse 5, his practice. Please notice how the family altar here is carried on after the children are gone. It was so that when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning Here's what he did. He offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Stop there for a minute. You and I maybe have a little bit of difficulty understanding burnt offering in related to New Testament theology. And so, of necessity, we have to understand, first of all, what the burnt offering was and what it amounted to, and then make a figurative or symbolic application of the truth. A burnt offering was one offering that was taken out of the storehouse of the best that the offerer had. In this case, an animal. There would be some value attached to it. It wouldn't be just any old animal, you know, the oldest one, or the sickest one, or the lame one. It was had value to it. And on the altar, these primitive altars of Job's day, they would first slay the animal. There's the sacrifice. And then they would set the animal ablaze, burnt offering, so that the entirety of the beast would be consumed on the altar. So when you think about the altar, think about total consumption. Parlay that into an application for me and you to total surrender. When you think about the altar then in Job's day, not only total consumption, but also a forfeiture of something that was deemed valuable by the offerer given to God, who alone was worthy of the offering. Now, having said that, why did he do it? Well, because in Job's culture, in the day of sacrifice, the animal sacrifice, it was offered to placate the wrath of God in the event that his children had sinned. You know, parents, be careful what you want to know about your children. And sometimes you'll agree with me that it's probably better if you don't know everything about your grown children. But Job, knowing something about human nature, knew also that they, like everybody else, himself included, would be subject to temptation. And it may be on occasion that they sinned. And of course, when a person sins, they alienate God. That's why a sinner is a sinner. That's why an unbeliever is doomed for hell, because he has alienated a holy God. And without a sacrifice applied to him or offered in his stead or for his benefit, he will perish without hope. But the believer, on the other hand, when you sin and when I sin, there's the tendency to do that, as was the case with Job's children. He wanted to be sure that on any given day that there was a sacrifice that was offered up for them, so that God would look favorably upon his sacrifice for his children and not exact vengeance upon his children for their evil. So we read here. Job sent and sanctified them, rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offering. Oh, by the way, is there anything about rose early in the morning? Now, there's nothing magical about early versus late. Nothing magical about early versus middle of the day to go about your religious exercise. But here, take this meaning. There was in this father's heart a sense of urgency. For if I know that there's a likelihood that my children may have alienated God, I want to get this squared away as quickly as I can. So he offered burnt offerings early, according to the number of them all. There was no impartiality. There was no, and listen, there was no assumption. You know, some parents make this flaw too, that have 2, 3, 4 children. They have their Jacob and their Esau. They have their Abels and their Cains. And they might tend to treat one child different from another child because of a perception that this child's a little bit nicer, a little bit less likely to transgress, and therefore I don't need to worry about him or her because they'll be okay. But the other one, that's a full-time project. Well, he offered up sacrifices for all of them. He was impartial in his fatherly obligations to worship, to sacrifice for his children. He looked upon all of them with equality, the same. It says, it may be that my sons have sinned in this particular way. They cursed God in their hearts. Cursed God in their hearts. Now, please notice something else about worship in the last part of that verse. What did he do? It is said of Job, he did what? He did this continuously. He did this continuously. Now, understand that when we gather here in the Lord's house on Sunday morning or Wednesdays, or whatever day is appointed for the Bible studies and prayer meetings of a church family. But typically on the Lord's Day we gather here, not because there's a desire to compartmentalize what we call worship, but this is the fountainhead from which springs out all piety for the week. From week to week we come in here each Sunday to be refreshed and charged again, so that we continue to worship Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We come back and we get recharged and refreshed again to worship continuously. Because there's no one day in the week that's any less likely in which sin would occur or not. They're all the same that way. But he had family altar. Now I want to think about this matter of a family altar, particularly about an altar. Give you some places to review here. Genesis 8. Genesis 8, verse 20. We'll be coming back to this momentarily. But in Genesis 8, 20, Noah builded an altar unto the Lord, took of every clean beast, every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So the altar is the place of worship. You say, well, now, do we have altars? Is there such a thing as a New Testament altar? Because in the Old Testament economy, the altar was central to worship. In the New Testament church, we have no altar, because the Word is central to worship. So then, how do we make application of the truth of an altar in our time? Will you hold on for a minute? In Genesis 22. Genesis 22, verse 9. Remember now, worship, service, sacrifice. Genesis 22, 9. And they came to the place which God had told him of, and Abraham built an altar there. And by the way, remember now, with Noah and with Abraham, where they went, they built the altar. That's a thought. Where they go, they build an altar, a place of sacrifice. He laid the wood in order, bound his Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. That's the place of sacrifice. Okay, a place of sacrifice. May I just say to you that the altar is a designated place for a designed purpose or a divine purpose. And where the altar was erected and where the sacrifice was given, it involved total consumption. It involved unconditional, total surrender of the sacrifice to God. Now remember, in the New Testament, we don't offer animal sacrifices. But what we do is offer living sacrifice. Romans 12, verse 1 says, present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto the Lord. Well, where's the altar? Every place, on every occasion where you worship, serve, and sacrifice, the altar is construed to be the place, the heart, the state of the heart where total sacrifice, unreserved commitment, full surrender is given. A living sacrifice is something that is offered on the altar of surrender. Because that's all that it implied, an altar of surrender. As a matter of fact, when you think about worship, look in Ephesians chapter 5 again.
real quickly. Got just a few minutes. Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5 and verse 2, where we're going to have a look at the standard for the sacrifice. Ephesians 5 verse 2, "And walk in love as Christ also hath loved us and hath given himself for us an offering and a sacrifice to God." And then please notice, and very important is this, a sweet smelling savor. A sweet smelling savor. That's the standard for sacrifice. Now, what is, when we think about a sweet smelling savor, we go back to Hebrews chapter number 13 for just a minute. Sweet smelling savor. And we find that that reference connected to the sacrifice has to do with whether or not God is going to accept it or not. In Hebrews 13, "Now the God of peace," verse 20, "that brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, the great shepherd of the sheep, through the blood of the everlasting covenant," now that's he's our sacrifice, "make you perfect in every good work to do his will, working in you that which is well-pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever." Had that said, you track back over to the 15th verse. "By him, our sacrifice, therefore let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually." Now that's worship in word. But if word is all that it involves and nothing else, it's not a sweet savor. "By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually. That is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." But then verse 16 says, "But to do good and communicate, forget not. For with such sacrifices, God is well pleased." So there must be worship not only in word, but in deed. Word and deed. And that's what's acceptable with God. Worship in word and in deed. That has a sweet smell. Look at Philippians chapter 4, please. Philippians 4. The 18th verse. Said, "I have all and abound, and I am full, having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, an odor," here's the deed part of worship, "an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God." A sweet savor is indicative of acceptability with God. Now, we do not make animal sacrifices, we make living sacrifices. The standard for our sacrifice is Christ's sacrifice, there in Ephesians 5, verse 2. And it exceeds all sacrifices of the type found in the Old Testament. Jesus was questioned, you remember, in Matthew 22 and also in Mark 12 is the account about worship. Someone asked him, "Master, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And he said, he put it this way, "Well, the first commandment is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments," he says, "hang all the law and the prophets." Now, Mark goes on to say in his account of Mark 12 and verse 33 that the standard that we must raise to in our worship, exceeding all the Old Testament sacrifice, must rise to the level of Christ's sacrifice. And it is to be found in our love for Him that has no rival. That's what essentially is at the core of our worship. Our love for our God. Our love for our God is at the core of all that we do when it comes to worship. Now, in conclusion, go back to Genesis chapter number 6. Family altar. Genesis 6 and verse 9, something about Noah here. It says of him in verse 9 that Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Can I just say this about Noah and apply it to your life and mine? Noah was a just man. And because he was, he walked with God. He worshiped God. Just men walk with God. Just men worship God. Over in Genesis 8, verse 20. We made mention of this before. Noah's family altar. Noah builded an altar unto the Lord and took of every clean beast, of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Then verse 21 says, and the Lord smelled a sweet savor, indicating that what Noah just did was acceptable to God. Noah gave the very best that he had. Noah was a just man. Noah walked with God. Noah worshiped God. And you'll always find that same link right across the line. Now, next week, I want to share with you the concluding part on our subject of worship that involves temple sweeping. A worshiper of God is a temple sweeper. So let's pray and give you some time to refresh yourself and prepare for the morning worship service.